Hi, this is Nidjo from Ultravox and Visage, and you're listening to Holly and Dave on What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
What is going on with yourself today on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
I'm giddy once again. I feel like I'm reaping something good today.
Reaping the wild wind. And you say that because who do we have today?
I have to calm myself down as I say. We have Midyear in the virtual studio with us today.
Midyear, he of Ultravox and Visage and Live Aid and Do They Know It's Christmas? And he was in Thin Lizzy for a bit, and he's been around. This guy's been around.
He was also in the boy band Slick.
Yeah, I figured you'd gravitate towards that. You love the boy bands. And he was a dreamy boy.
He was super dreamy.
Yes. And now we get the super dreamy Midyear into our studio, which is really exciting. We're going to go through his entire career. And he was super nice about everything. So we're talking a lot about Midge, and you're going to be very excited to hear this interview because we're very excited about it. And it lives on social media. Where will this interview live on?
It does. It will live on our YouTube channel at What Difference Does It Make podcast and on our other social media at WDDIM podcast. We will show outtakes and you will see what a nice guy Midge is and how much he's accomplished in his young 70-year-old life.
He was in Germany at the time. It is super early for us. 8 a.m. was a start time, which is just too early for us. But we had our coffee. You got your coffee, Holly?
Yes, I have my coffee right here. And if Midge had asked us to do this at 3 a.m. our time, I would happily have done it.
Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind for the next time when we talk to someone in Australia. It's 8 a.m. We're fired up. We've loaded up on the coffee. So why don't we get into our virtual studio interview with Midyear on the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Midge. How are you?
Hey, can you hear me okay?
We can. Yes. Yes.
It's just me in a corporate box in an arena somewhere with the orchestra and the band doing the sound check in the background. Like, I can't find anywhere quiet to do this. So you're going to have to live with it, I'm afraid.
So you're in Germany?
I'm in Germany, yeah. I've been doing this Rock Meets Classic tour. It's great fun. Bunch of singers who would normally never share the stage together. But these things work in Germany. It's amazing.
How so? What's making this come together?
It's a tour. This thing has been happening for quite a few years now here in Germany. This is the third time I've done one of these. The first one that I did 10 years ago, the headliner was Alice Cooper. So I have photographs of me and Alice Cooper singing Schools Out together. Now, that was never on my radar. I never thought that would happen. But isn't this life wonderful? Things do happen and you find yourself doing it. It's a really popular thing here in Europe, this idea of the orchestra. There's a soprano singer on right now who was one of the singers with the Finnish band Nightwish, who are like a death metal band. So it's an amazing hybrid of all sorts of music, the way music kind of should be, I think.
Is there anybody else tonight?
We've got John Hellman, who's the sax player in, God, my brain's gone now, Breakfast America.
Supertramp.
That's it. Thank you. How could I forget?
Yeah.
I have a guy called Russ Ballard, who wrote songs for Rainbow, and everything. Used to be in a band called Argent.
Oh, yeah.
So it's an interesting combination of people.
Is that why you posted on Twitter? I saw a thing about the band Free with Paul Rogers. Like, is that you're in that mindset now? What's going on with your, where are you musically?
It's just the way you find yourself. Free was a band that everyone loved. Their average age when that band came out was like 19, and they were supremely talented. And everyone was enthused about it. No, it's on social media. People post these things, usually things about yourself that you've never seen or heard, TV shows you did when you were a kid that you've forgotten all about, and these things surface, and you like them, and all of a sudden everyone thinks these are wonderful. But yeah, Paul Rogers has done one of these as well. So a lot of people come along and do it because it's a different experience. You don't have the opportunity to work with an orchestra very often. So when it happens and it comes up, you jump at it.
We have this at the Hollywood Bowl. When you got to come, you bring it to the Hollywood Bowl, would you?
I'm waiting. I'm waiting for the invite. The best thing I ever saw, I'll tell you, the best thing I ever saw at the Hollywood Bowl, the first time I ever went, a friend of mine in Los Angeles said, oh, we're doing the bowl tonight. Pick up some tickets and come and see this. It's songs from the shows. And I thought, I think I'd rather have my teeth pulled. And I went, and it was all the American Songbook, and it was all people who had appeared in television shows in America coming on and singing these songs. Then we had these guys come on, and I'm thinking, I'm not sure who this is. It was Dick Van Dyke came on stage with his sons, who looked as old as he was. And he came on and he introduced himself and he said, good evening, I'm what's left of Dick Van Dyke. And I just thought that was hysterical. And he went into a rap version of Chim Chimini. And, you know, you again, I think I'm doing some strange things, but that was a really strange experience, but a great one.
Okay, so we've been going down the rabbit hole, going through your career. I guess the strangest thing, when you started out, what was it? What was the band?
Slick. I'm all about Slick.
Slick. Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah, that was a long time ago. Yeah.
The one we saw was Top of the Pops. You must have been like Paul Rogers' age, probably like 19, 20 at that time.
Yeah, it was around that, early 20s, I think, was Slick. First time doing Top of the Pops. An interesting experience.
Interesting. And I couldn't tell if you were having fun.
It was kind of fun. The reason it wasn't, you know, the highlight of my life, I was born in Glasgow in Scotland, and the band travelled all the way down to London to make a first record. And we walked into the studio, and they had the session guys in that morning, the same guys who played in all the Bay City Rollers tunes. It was the same writers, same producers, and they treated us the same way. So when our record got to number one in the UK, we felt nothing. We didn't contribute. We didn't play it. We weren't allowed to do anything with it. So it was a bittersweet experience. Didn't you know? Didn't you feel? Couldn't you tell that it was real? Couldn't you tell that it was real? I dedicate to you all my love, my whole. Change it. Like even the bad bits in a career are sometimes good.
And a learning experience.
And a massive learning experience, of course. You learn never to allow someone to do it to you again. You kind of vow to yourself that rather than doing what other people want you to do for them, try and do what you want to do. And hopefully someone out there will recognize what it is you're doing and they'll empathize with you and they'll get some kind of solace, you know, from that. And that's what I've tried to do since like, so it was a learning experience. Yeah,
I guess conversely, you had a Malcolm McLaren wanted you in the Sex Pistols. So I mean, he wanted, you could have been in either one of those bands. Was that a choice you had at that time?
It wasn't at the time. I didn't realize that that's kind of what it was. I mean, I was already in Slick. I was already playing in this band. We're just about to make this first single. And I was stopped in the streets of Glasgow, not because I was a musician, but because of how I looked. You know, when everyone else had really long, feather-cut hair, you know, I had a James Dean quiff, believe it or not. And the guy who stopped me in the street was Bernie Rhodes, who went on to manage The Clash. And he just said, look, can you speak to my friend around the corner about music? And his friend was Malcolm McLaren, who obviously I didn't know. This was 1974 or something, 75. And he told me about the New York Dolls. He told me about Vivian Westwood and his shop and making clothes. And then he said, I'm putting a band together. Do you want to join? And I said, well, you haven't even asked if I'm a musician. You don't know what I do. You're asking me because of, you know, periphery, not the core of it all. So I turned it down, and of course, lo and behold, it was the Pistols. So there's no chance of me joining the Pistols. It was just the wrong thing.
That's such a fluke. They're so weird.
It's such a fluke, yeah.
I'm trying to imagine someone saying, hey, come around the corner and talk to somebody about music now. Wait a minute.
It's a very dodgy concept. There is a reason I went there, and it's because the local venue in Glasgow, the Glasgow Apollo, which became the famous venue in the UK, they used to manage the band I was in. And when bands would come and play there, if they had a broken piece of equipment, you couldn't just call up a rental company now and they'd come and drop something off for you. They'd say, go around the corner to the music shop and find Midge. He's always in the music shop. And he'll sort you out with an amplifier or a guitar or whatever. And I thought, because it was an English guy stopping me in the streets about music, I thought, well, it's bound to be some band who needs a guitar. And of course, it wasn't. So I have to say, first and foremost, McLaren picked the right guys. He picked a great band. He picked just the perfect people to do that task. And of course, one of the perfect people was Glenn Matlock, the original bass player. And rumour has it, they kicked him out because he liked the Beatles. He was too melodic. And I ended up joining up with Glenn because someone, a music journalist from one of the music papers, the NME or Melody Maker or something, said, I know you're looking for this mythical singer, this fourth person for the Rich Kids. You should see that guy who was in Slick. And he said, oh, I loved Slick. And he called me up and that was it. Next thing I knew, I was packing my bags and heading south to London.
That's weird. Everyone loves Slick, this teenage boy band, and everyone's into it.
The thing is, irrespective of how cool all the punks thought they were,
yeah,
they'd all watch Top of the Pops. Everyone watched Top of the Pops.
But you hired a singer for his look, for Visage. Apparently, you wanted someone who had that perfect look, who could be the front man, and that was, you want to talk to me about your lead singer of Visage?
Of course. Visage was born out of the demise of the Rich Kids. You know, the Rich Kids lasted a year or so. 1978, I bought a synthesizer, which killed the band. Immediately split the band in two. Glenn and Steve hated it. Rusty Egan and I loved it. We could see the potential of using this new instrument in amongst traditional rock instruments. And one of the things that we talked about as we walked around London, with no money at all, with nothing going for us, and we would dream of ideas of what would happen next year or the year after or whatever. And one of the ideas we came up with was to put a studio project together utilizing our favorite musicians. One of the favorite musicians was Billy Curry, keyboard player in Ultravox, and three of the guys from the band Magazine from Manchester. We talked about this and we thought, well, we need a singer. I can't sing. I've just joined Ultravox. You know, I was just about to join Ultravox. So I'm still in the Rich Kids. Magazine was still touring and Ultravox was still touring. So we thought, we need someone to kind of front this. I don't want to sing it. So we approached everyone. Everyone was up for the idea. And Rusty said, well, my friend Steve was in a punk band and he'd love to be here. So he works in a clothes shop, lo and behold, could you guess? And Steve turned up and we said, perfect, this is great. Steve and Rusty were running a little club in London one night a week, a little club called Billy's. And all the cool kids would go to Billy's for a Bowie night, they called it. And that's where Rusty would find all these fantastic pieces of music coming out of Germany or Austria or Belgium or France and play these electronic things in a disco. And they sounded phenomenal. So we wanted to make our interpretation of that. So yeah, Steve came along and fronted the entire project.
Now, this is Steve Strange, and he also worked another club. Tell us a little bit about being a Blitz kid right there.
Yeah, the Blitz. The Blitz was the little club Billy's that they ran on a Tuesday night or something. It got so popular, they had to move to another venue. So they moved to a wine bar, which was already called Blitz, as in World War II Blitz. So it was done up like a 1940s cocktail bar. And they took that over one night a week. And at this point, the music had started to kind of creep out and people were starting to understand that something was happening. Certainly the tabloid newspapers, and they wanted to see all these kids who were turning up wearing the grandmother's wardrobe from the 1930s or raiding their grandfather's wardrobe and wearing a lovely double-breasted suit and really cool, yeah. And they had their hair looking smart. And these kids had all started the whole punk movement. But by the time their younger brother or younger siblings got into the punk movement, they wanted nothing to do with it anymore. They wanted to move on and be different. So the Blitz Club was born, and it became notorious for kids not, you know, coming from work and then dressing in the toilets and getting changed and then going to the club. These kids were coming from home dressed the way they were. They lived this. This was part of what they were doing. We wouldn't allow Steve used to sit on the door. Rusty would DJ, Steve would sit on the door, and he would say, "You can come in, you can't, I don't like your shirt, you're a journalist, you can't come in." And they notoriously turned away Mick Jagger in his entourage because he didn't think they were cool enough to be in the club.
We are talking with Midge Ure right now, but, you know, as it happens, we need to take a break, so let's do that right now.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
We're back on the What Difference Does It Make podcast with our guest, Midge Ure.
We had Dylan Jones on the show and talking about his book, The New Romantic Period. Do you like that term, New Romantic? Is that something you...
I always hated it, but you find that musicians don't usually tag themselves. They don't come in and say, unless you're a rock band, everyone has to say you're a rock band. But you don't say, I'm this genre and I will never deviate from that genre. It's either good or bad. It's not necessarily about... We're not a library, you know. It's not a library with a that's the soul section, and this is the jazz section. This is the blues section. These days, the lines are blurred. So the term "new romantic" was something that the media termed because it's difficult to explain and describe something new. So it's a lot easier to say it's a bit like, and then give some reference points. And new romanticism was something that they kind of created.
Was the U.S. music scene anything to you back in the day, or was it just like you had your own little world, like you went to your local record shop and was just trying to figure out what the new sound could be?
I think at that period, it didn't really cross our minds. Think about it, in the late 70s, we were doing this in 78, we started Visage. 79, I joined Ultravox because of the Visage project. And what was coming out of America at the time was so alien to us. because it was kind of like corporate rock. It was poodle hairdos. It was the antithesis of what we were doing. What we were trying to do was make European music that wasn't necessarily based in jazz or blues like most other musics were. But saying that, I'd never have learned to play guitar if I hadn't listened to some of what was coming out of America in the 50s and 60s, the classical blues players. So I picked up my guitar skills from doing that. So you can't ignore any particular influence. But at that moment in time, in that particular genre of music, it was about Europeanness. It was almost robotic in its way. It was kind of cold and distant, which was the opposite of what America was doing at the time.
Yeah, it was Supertramp back then.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. You know, these guys were nailing it. You know, you guys' stations that would play nothing but Stairway to Heaven for 24 hours a day. So non-stop loops. So therefore, when Ultravox came out there in 79, I think, the first time I came, you know, some people on the coasts got it, some of the cool clubs got it, but the radio just didn't know what to do with this.
It was that kind of rock here until K-Rock came along.
K-Rock was great because they picked up on a lot of stuff and pioneered a lot of music change in America. You know, you had people like The Cure, you know, selling out at Pasadena Rose Bowl or Depeche Mode, yeah. You know, and you think, well, wow, it was unheard of. And in the meantime, Ultravox was still playing sticky carpeted clubs.
So was being played on John Peel's show, was that the ultimate? Was that like, okay, we've made it? What was the indicator that you were on the right track?
With Ultravox, we were kind of disillusioned by the music industry in the UK, and quite rightly so. It seemed very repetitive. We seemed to want to only sign things that had already been successful, or things that were like things that were successful. They didn't really want to take a chance on it. So we had an A&R guy coming from America to sit in the rehearsal studio where we wrote all the material. We wrote everything together as a band. And he sat there for 3 days and watched us from walking in with an idea of me saying, I've got this line in my head, this means nothing to me over Vienna. And he watched that turn into the final thing over the 3 day period, the piano, the viola, the whole structure, and then didn't sign us.
In the cold air, freezing breath on a window pane, lying and waiting. A man in the dark in a picture frame, so mystic and soulful. Reaching out in a piercing cry, it stays with you until
it was a very odd process that we were going through at the time. But it was an exciting process for us, according to everyone outside the band. We were dead and gone. We were finished. Ultravox had had the 3 albums. They'd had the 2 or 3 years of doing this, and they were never going to be seen again. And lo and behold, we get together and revitalize the entire thing. So it was an incredibly exciting period, but whether anyone would get it or not, we didn't know. So Vienna album came out the same day the Visage album came out, and the first singles charted on the same day. It was crazy. So 3 singles in, everyone kept saying, Vienna's got to be a single, but you have to edit it. And we said, no, what do you edit? What do you cut out? The intro's sets it up. You cut out the viola solo, that's kind of important, you know, or the end, the big climax, you can't cut that out. So we just said to the record label, get the same people who edited, you know, Hey Jude and, you know, Wuthering Heights and, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody. And they said, but they weren't edited. And he said, precisely.
Whatever.
So when that came out, it was incredibly fortunate that someone picked up on it. It could have disappeared, never been heard. And that changed everything.
It was like Blur versus Oasis between Visage and Ultravox. That's kind of fun.
It was really odd. It was a really odd thing. I remember I was in a rehearsal studio working with Ultravox, about to go on tour, and a manager turned up, which was odd in itself. Managers don't turn up to rehearsal studios because they're usually horrible places. And he turned up with two magnums of champagne and said, you've got two albums in the charts and you've got two singles in the charts.
And so the first five Ultravox albums hit the top 10. It was kind of like what Slick was hoping to do. Like, they had a formula, but Ultravox, I don't know, you just struck a chord with the UK audience. Those albums are just amazing, but it never struck in the US. Did you tour? I'm sure that was your goal. Like, we got to hit it. We're going to tour. We're going to make it. What's your theory on why it never happened?
It's just too easy to turn around and blame the label. And say, oh, they didn't get it, they didn't understand it. They wanted to do remixes, they wanted to do MOR mixes of stuff, and we just said, no, it doesn't work. It either works or it doesn't, and it works the way it is. And also, we kind of shot ourselves in the foot because we were such a technical band. It became very complex. In order to play what we had created live, it would take a five-hour sound check. So every place we played, we had to have specific equipment that was altered and manipulated in order for the drum machine to talk to the MIDI book, you know, because they didn't have a language. MIDI hadn't been invented. You couldn't just plug two things in and they would understand each other. So that meant we had to have two of everything. So if the MIDI book broke or one of the synths went down or the drum machine didn't happen, you had to have a spare. You couldn't just rent one in because it didn't work. So we toured in America quite a few times, and we got up to doing like the Avery Fisher Hall in New York, you know, a couple of thousand in capacity. We were one of the few rock bands that was allowed to play Avery Fisher because it was deemed art. It was something above and beyond just a smelly rock band. So we got to that level. And then the next logical step would be open up for a bigger band doing, you know, some of the sheds or doing outdoor things, stadiums or whatever. And you can't do that with a five-hour sound check. So we just stalemated. We just stopped.
Now you have plenty of bands touring all these years later.
Yeah, now you could do it in a box. I've heard you could do this.
And you can. In fact, that's what I'm going to be doing. It's all changed. Everything understands. Everything's compatible. Everything's fixable and doable. Our option was five-hour sound check or put things on tape. And we absolutely refused to do that. We just said, no, it doesn't work. It's not a band anymore then.
So for this, for Band in a Box, you will only have two people on stage.
We do. And I did it 2 years ago on Howard Jones's tour. He asked me the year before to come on because he wanted to do a very authentic electronic tour. And we've known each other for years. And I said, well, I'd love to do it, but I couldn't bring an entire band. Fiscally, it doesn't work. It was wonderful. They figured out a way that I could possibly do this thing and use his keyboard player. So I figured out, well, okay, if I could use his keyboard player, I can program a lot of the stuff, like the synth basses and some drum things and whatever, loops and samples. I can play keyboards as well, and I do guitar live and we sing live. And it's as close as you can get in a kind of compressed, compact way to enable you to play some of the old stuff, some of the old Ultravox things, some of the old Visage things, but do it in a very authentic but powerful manner. And I had doubts about it when we started the tour a couple of years ago, but then people loved it. I was stunned. They absolutely loved it because they were getting to hear as close as they could get to hear Visage or Ultravox live. And I thought, well, okay, they kept pressing me to come back and do it again, and that's what I'm going to do.
The fans just want to hear the music.
They do. They want to hear the songs. They want to hear the songs that they've heard on records all those years ago, or they heard when they were in college at college radio stations. And to get to hear those things as live as they can be, it's great. The reaction that people had was just immense. It was wonderful.
Something so programmed. Is there room for stretching things out a bit, or is it kind of formatted in a way? I've always been curious about things like that.
I think that the very nature of it needs to be slightly formatted, but that doesn't mean it's the same every night, because I end up singing the wrong verses. I end up getting the words wrong. And the horrible thing is I can see people down the front singing the right words. There's an element, anything that involves humans, there's an element of things going wrong, and there's an essence of things being different. So it's not the same guitar solo every night. It's not the same vocal performance every night. That human element outrides the fact that it's a fixed lens.
As fans, we just think you're changing it up for us.
It's jazz, I think.
That's right. So you got to work with George Martin for All in One Day. I'm kind of curious what that experience was like for you as someone, I'm sure, who loved the Beatles.
Oh, he was the master. I've been incredibly fortunate in my life and my career that I've got to work with people that I love and respect and admire, rather than people that other people wanted me to work with. You know, most duets, most of the artists never meet. You know, it's done by record labels. So my duet with Kate Bush was out of love and respect for each other. And to work with someone like George Martin was an amazing opportunity. We were very kind of trepidatious about it at first, thinking, what if he's not kept up with technology? What if he doesn't really understand what it is we're trying to do? And of course, the first day in the studio, George is sitting with a brand new drum machine, and he's timing the delay that he would have to put on the snare to make it sound more human. And I'm thinking, my God, he's way ahead of us. Sure. He's not lagged behind at all. He's absolutely on top of all this stuff. And to sit around the piano with someone, and Ultravox needed this, someone who would say, you know what, you've said this now, just let's edit the end of this. You don't need to keep going up and, you know, key changing, getting spirals and keep this thing going for 10 minutes. You know, you're not a prog band. So let's sit around the piano. And of course, when George would say that, you'd kind of doff your cap and say, absolutely so. and edit things down. Now, most of Ultravox wouldn't have taken that, but with George Martin, you take it. It was that dreadful saying, why buy a dog and bark yourself? You know, you've got a brilliant producer there. Don't argue with him. Just listen to what he's got to say and learn from the man.
We could touch a world where every heart had loved to offer. Die!
And he was also one of the nicest people I'd ever met. He was like the school teacher. He was just this lovely, warm man who, in between work, would tell you some of the most amazing stories. It was wonderful. I would have paid money just to sit and listen.
Right. So then you had your own experience. You had this song. I don't know if you know, Do They Know It's Christmas? There was like a lot going on in that. How do you control a situation like that?
Kind of easy. I mean, Geldof's, you know, Bob Geldof's a power in his own right. You know, he demands respect because he's a very knowledgeable, very smart guy. And nobody says no to Bob. So when he calls up Duran and says, right, it's Sunday morning, 8 o'clock, Psalm Studios, London, be there, you know, they're there. You know, there's a moment, where Bob and I spent 4 days putting the backing track together. I played all the instruments on the record. So I played this thing in my studio. We got the one 24-hour period at Psalm Studios in London to do all the vocals, Phil Collins' drums, and mix the record. It had to be finished the next morning at 8 o'clock to get to the pressing plants in order for it to be out in time for Christmas. And there's Bob and I standing there after he's run up a massive telephone bill in my studio calling all these artists. I'm trying to play all the instruments and get them to shut up and just let me get on with doing what I do. And I'm standing outside the studio on a cold Sunday morning, and Bob leans over to me in front of all these cameras and microphones, and I'll use the very words he used. You can bleep it out later. And he leans over and says, you know, we don't know who's actually coming. And I said, yeah. I said, because we didn't really speak to an adult, did we? We spoke directly to the artists, and they wouldn't have written it down. So, and he said, if it's just the Boomtown Rats and Ultravox, you know, and I thought, you are absolutely right. We had no idea who was going to turn up, but they did. They all turned up, except Boy George, who forgot. And Bob told him, get on Concorde. And he bought a ticket for Concorde and he flew in. We didn't pay for it, he paid for it.
Amazing. Did you see The Greatest Night in Pop? Were you getting PTSD? I would imagine like that was a similar situation.
Well, theirs was much more organized and it was hysterical because ours was amateur hour compared to that with a song that nobody had heard because you couldn't play it to them. It wasn't like these days you can send an MP3 and they can learn the song before they even get to the studio. We hadn't assigned who was singing what because we didn't know who was coming. We hadn't written enough lines in the song for everyone to have a complete line to sing. So I'm sitting there with a pen and a set of lyrics, drawing lines through the middle of song lines, going, well, if he sings that bit, we can maybe get him to do this part. We were kind of making it up on the fly, but that came out on the record. So there's something magical about it. And I'm not saying it because I did it, but there is something naive and wonderful about it. To have all these artists all standing in front of their contemporaries, petrified to open their mouth in case they got the notes wrong or yodeled or coughed or whatever. But we were all there egging each other on, all wanting each other to do something because by this point, everyone had seen the footage. Everyone knew exactly why they were doing this. You know, everyone was sickened with what we were watching. So they wanted to make this the best 24 hours they could make. And I think that comes out still on the record. When I hear that, the opening of that tune, the clanging chimes of doing that dong, dong, which is all my voice and multi-track and stuff, all of that stuff, it still has the same effect. The hair still stands up in my arms. There's no need to be afraid at Christmas time. And it's not necessarily because I think back to what I was doing. I think back to what that record actually did. You know, as a piece of plastic, that thing changed an awful lot in the world.
And I'm sure the experience prepared you for pretty much for anything after that.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, well, it's the only way's down. Once you've written something that's the biggest selling record in musical history in the UK, there is no up. So you have to be prepared for the fall.
This was for charity. Was this your first foray into that? Because I think you've done quite a lot since then.
It was kind of the first one. There was a thing called Comic Relief, which was done for Amnesty International. And I seem to remember Bob and I standing on a microphone backing Sting. There was a comic musical event that would happen in a theatre, you know, and it happened maybe a couple of years prior to Band Aid. And it was my first foray into that, I suppose, was that. I mean, everyone did it. But it was so much easier to just put your hand in your pocket and donate some money than actually commit to doing something. And once you commit to doing something like Band Aid, you can't walk away from it. Because the nature of what it is, you know, Bob and I wrote that song. We gave the songwriting royalties forever to the Band Aid Trust. So the Band Aid Trust is a body of people that we put together to make sure that we got this right. And we didn't get it right all the time, but we're there. So we had the head of the BBC. We had Harvey Goldsmith, who's puts on massive concerts. And, you know, music business managers, music business lawyers all came together thinking this was a six-month project. We're coming up for a 40th year. At the end of this year, it'll be 40 years since we made that record.
Amazing.
And we're still there. Yeah. We're still there doing it. So it kind of, everything changed at that point. Once people saw the power that music had back then, I'm not convinced it has the same power now, because young people diversify, they've got these things, and this 24-hour this, and non-stop whatever. Everything back then, think of the time, 1984, everything was music. Music was the be-all. It's the vehicle we all used to lose ourselves in. It was our entertainment. It was our compassion. It was our solace. It was our warm blanket around us when we needed it. You know, now people find other ways of getting that kick. So at that moment in time, it was the best thing we could possibly have done. And as I say, once you're in it, there are other things. I'm an ambassador for Save the Children. You know, I've got four daughters. You know, you worry about them and it never stops. So you start to have empathy for other children, you know. So it's not all about me anymore. It's not about me and what my record is and what I'm doing. It's kind of like, well, I've got this tiny little platform that I can use, you know. One voice shouting in the world doesn't always get heard. But a mass of voices shouting the same thing does get heard. And we proved that.
Okay, let's talk about UUU for a second. So last year you had a 70th birthday party, which is kind of cool. Like, okay, where are we going to throw it? Well, you know, how about Royal Albert Hall? Well, that's a good place.
It was a great place. I intended on doing anything. I try and avoid birthdays as much as possible. But my agent in the UK, my promoter in the UK, said, well, what do you want to do for your birthday? I said, don't know, go with the family or something. He said, surely you want to play? I said, well, yeah, of course. And he said, well, what about the Albert Hall? But because of lockdown, COVID lockdown, postponements, everything was pushed away a year, 2 years. Trying to get the Albert Hall around my birthday is short notice. And I'm talking about a year short notice. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible. Then a date came up 4 or 5 days before my birthday. And we thought, okay, let's go for it. And it was glorious. It was amazing, because you tend not to think that your music, that what you create as a musician, might affect other people. You know that other people's music have affected me, because that's how we become who we are. You know, those pieces of music still live inside me, even though I've maybe not heard them for 40, 50 years. Other people's music shape how your life is going to end up. And you kind of forget that sometimes there are people on the planet whose lives have been shaped because of something happened. And all those people came out of the woodwork to celebrate with me. So people flying in from Australia and Japan and New Zealand and America, whatever, to be there, just to be there to help celebrate and live that moment with me. And I just thought that was wonderful. So it was absolutely amazing. So I could have walked on and sung in a telephone book and people would still have loved it. It was one of those nights. I could have sung all the verses wrong and they wouldn't have cared. You know?
Is okay. We're going to talk about a couple of songs from the set list that just give your thoughts on it. The one song that hit in the U.S. is Dear God. And that's what you opened up with. What started the thought process of writing that song?
Well, I during lockdown, I saw a lot of artists doing little concerts like this on the computers. And as good as the artists were, the production values were dreadful. because it's still the camera in there and it's the mic in there and it didn't sound good. So I set up my little backstage lockdown club where I've got multi-cameras and I've got a vocal mic that's compressed and, you know, it echoes and stuff. So it sounds like a proper performance and looks like a proper performance. And I set that up to keep myself connected. I play the first song. Every week I do this, I start with Dear God. And I tell people that I'm not going to not play Dear God at the beginning of that broadcast until the world gets better, which means I'm going to be playing it forever. And because the world's gone crazy. And Dear God's such a simple, naive tune. It's like a child's like prayer, mm-hmm. but without being religious. It's got religious connotations. And I'm not a religious person. I spend half my life condemning what people do in the name of religions. And I did that, and I thought, well, you know, what a great way to do the Albert Hall when everyone expects you to turn up with an orchestra, walk on stage and sing Dear God with just an acoustic guitar. And you could have heard a pin drop. It was just great.
Dear God, is there somebody out there? Is there someone to hear my prayer? I'm a simple man with simple words to say. Is there some point in asking? Asking for more, only God is where we are today. Lost and alone and afraid. Give me love for the lonely. Give me food for the hungry. Give me peace in a restless world.
So it was the right place and the right time. And sadly, it's still the right time to perform that song. Mm.
Okay. You had one number one song, and this was called If I Was. You would think that's what you would end the set with. But you know what? You got so many hits. Let's just put our number one song right in the middle. Like, tell me about If I Was and what the feeling is when you do hit number one in the UK.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, a number one record at any time is wonderful. It's quite something. It's quite achieving. And it was at the time when it meant something. You know, not, I couldn't tell you what number one is anywhere anymore. You don't have to sell many records to be number one. It involves streaming and it involves, you know, who looks at it on YouTube or whatever, social media. But that was when you had to have a record that was played a lot and sold a lot of copies. So it was great to have that. Songs are funny things. And again, I'll say this. Songs are kind of like your children. You know, you love them because they're yours. But it doesn't mean you like them all the time. They can drive you crazy. So you have to be selective about what you do with these things. And I know a lot of artists stack the end of the show with all the big hits so that everyone walks away thinking, ah, how wonderful was that? I have to go and buy the best of. I have to go and listen to all the great songs. And sometimes for me, it's easier just to kind of bury those ones in the middle of a set somewhere. You know, and it's more important to play the ones that maybe they don't know so well. You know, the album cuts, the album tracks and things. I have to be happy with what I'm doing as well. It comes off stage, it's just like watching an actor on stage who hasn't learned these lines and walks through it because he can't be bothered. People pick up on that stuff. You know, you have to put set together as highs and lows and intimate moments and in-your-face moments. And I kind of pride myself on doing that.
So you do put a lot of thought into the set list, like how it flows.
I hope so, and I hope people get that. That it's, you know, it's not always best finishing on the big wham bam thank you ma'am hits. Sometimes it's best leaving them thinking something a little bit more poignant and, you know, a little more heartfelt.
Which I guess is why you end with him, the Ultravox song. A great song.
Well, that's a bit of both, isn't it? You know, again, it's giving six religions a good telling off, but in a wham bam thank you ma'am kind of way, it's got that big chorus that people just find very appealing. There's something about it that you can sing along with it, and they feel part of the event. So yeah.
Some people might take you as religious.
There's a lot of it's my background. It's funny, when I was born in Glasgow, a big religious divide, a bit like Northern Ireland, you know, Catholic, Protestant, football teams, soccer teams associated with them. I never liked football. I've never been a soccer fan because of that. Because of this, it's a reason to get a punch in the mouth or a punch in the nose. I just thought, music's my way out of this, so that's what I've always done. But I do write about the simplicity of what life should be and what the teachings are in any religion. It should be right from wrong, good from bad. That's what I've taught my kids. I haven't had them christened. They will choose if they want religion in their lives. They can choose what they want. I'm not going to keep handing down bigotry. It's something you've got to draw a line and go, okay, take it somewhere else now. Go and do whatever. You want to be a Buddhist? You do that. That's great.
So the Glasgow music scene, when you were a kid, was there a scene? What was it like back then?
It was funny again, without wanting to bang on about religion. When I was a kid playing in bands in Glasgow, in and around Glasgow throughout Scotland, the church ran the licensing laws in the pubs. So we'd be reading in the Melody Maker news, whatever, you know, music papers, about this pub rock circuit in England. Because they had all the pubs, you could go and see bands playing every night. And you'd pay, you know, a dollar or whatever, and you'd go in and you'd see some great band who were just on their way up. And we didn't have that. We weren't allowed to do, they wouldn't allow people to pay to go into a pub for entertainment. Some weird ancient law. And I think it might still be like that. So a lot of the bands that I saw coming up through the circuit, they never really went beyond playing in Scotland. Because by the time they'd moved to London, where everything was London-centric, you know, the music industry was there, the agents were there, the recording studios were there, all the facilities were there. Of course, these big bands in Scotland, like Human Jukeboxes, playing top 40 hits, and they'd go to London with a handful of songs they'd written, and find out that they weren't top of the heap anymore. They were a very small fish in a very, very, very big pool. Yeah. So it was a very strange time. So when I moved to London to join the Rich Kids in 1978, Simple Minds stayed behind because there were independent record labels, punk labels started coming up, and Simple Minds signed to one of those, and they managed to do it staying in Glasgow. And it wasn't until I moved away that all of these great Scottish bands all started appearing. So I missed out on all that.
Yeah, you certainly did. Okay, you covered Tom Rush's No Regrets. Did you know it was a Tom Rush song, or was it because of the Walker Brothers?
It was the Walker Brothers version that I heard. Okay. In fact, when I was in Slick and we were on Top of the Pops doing our hit, the Walker Brothers were on Top of the Pops singing No Regrets.
Okay.
And I vowed that, I mean, I loved the song and I loved the Walker Brothers. And I vowed that when I was allowed to do what I wanted to do in music and not what someone else wanted me to do, that I would do a cover of that. And I worked in a studio with a friend helping him produce a record. And he said, well, what would you like for doing this? I said, just give me a day in the studio. And he gave me a day in the studio and I recorded the entire track in that one day. And it's just an homage to Tom Rush as a writer, and the Walker Brothers has just been the Walker Brothers. They're brilliant.
And there's one other cover song. Well, you wrote it, but it was Phil Lynott, the Yellow Pearl. It's a funny song in that it sounds like Thin Lizzy doing Ultra Vibes. I guess it was a natural transition. What was Phil's reaction? Yeah, tell me about that. It's like the creation of
what it was the line of singing, you know, with the electronic background. It was a bit odd. My first ever time in America was to come out and replace Gary Moore from Thin Lizzy. Thin Lizzy were doing the opening slots for Journey.
Yeah.
So they're playing Megadeth, you know. And Gary Moore, the Whiz Kid guitar player, was out of the band. I was in the studio putting the finishing touches to the first Visage album, so I was finishing off Fade to Grey. I had just joined Ultravox, although, as I said before, nobody was interested in what Ultravox were doing. And I got the phone call from Philip Lynott saying, hi, we're in Arkansas. Can you fly out tomorrow and come and finish the tour on guitar? And my brain screamed, you're not good enough. I'm not a Whiz Kid guitar player. But my heart said, don't be stupid. This is great. I mean, what an opportunity this is, you know. So I find myself going back in the studio, finding a pile of cassettes on my doorstep and a set list and an envelope to tell me that that was a car picking me up in the morning to take me to the airport. So I packed my bags and I got my big ghetto blaster and my headphones way before Walkmans. And I thought, I'll learn all the songs on the set, on the plane, because it's a long flight. They flew me out on Concorde. So I'm halfway through working out the chords for the second song and we landed in New York. So my first night in American soil was in New Orleans in a hotel room with Scott, the other guitar player, learning all the harmony guitar parts. And the next night, we were on stage in front of 30,000 people playing The Boys Are Back in Town. It was wonderful. It was great.
We've talked a lot about these songs. Are we going to hear these when you're touring here, coming to the States? What is your game plan? What is your set list going to look like?
Well, it's kind of a bit of everything right now. There's quite a few Ultravox. There are quite a few Ultravox tracks in there, a few solo things. For some reason, my album, Answers to Nothing, was very popular and amongst the American audience, which is great. So I'm delving into some of that, which I haven't played for a long time. Now, whether I delve into any Thin Lizzy things, I don't think people would kind of understand the connection at all. I think I've had some kind of hemorrhage or something, and all of a sudden he's playing a Thin Lizzy song. What's going on? I'm delving into my past to enable me, as I say, to play songs that when I've toured in America recently, and I've done it with just an acoustic guitar or whatever, you know, it doesn't work in that format. A lot of it doesn't work. So I'm delving into the ones that do work in this format. So yeah, a lot of Ultravox things, a few Visage things, and a lot of solo things as well.
Okay, explain the cover of your solo album. Were you like the matinee idol, the black and white? I love it. Who took the picture? It looked like, I mean, it looks like something that would be on the Smiths cover, you know, because you're just gorgeous in that.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah. I'll do this again.
Yeah.
I'll tell you who it was. It was done in Hollywood. It was done by a photographer named George Harrell. And George Harrell was one of the original Hollywood photographers. There were two or three of them who specialized in making your skin look like a peach, you know. And if you look up George Harrell and look who he photographed, every Hollywood icon you could think of, that very distinct black and white look, the shadows up the wall, and, you know, and it throws you in a kind of weird way. You sit like this and you think, this feels really unnatural. And then he'd take the photograph, and he took photographs on a big old plate camera, big glass plate camera. He'd come back to you like 3 months later with the finished article. And what he did was, what they did in those days, they'd scratch the glass. So the negative photograph, they'd scratch the negative some way, and it blended the whole thing. Your whole face would just blend. No wrinkles, no creases, no shiny bits, just this idol-like photograph. And they made all these Hollywood stars look godlike. You know, if you could imagine what God might look like, it would look blemish-free and wonderful. So he did that, and he was in his 80s when I did that photo shoot. And I asked if he would do the shoot, and he was so pleased about it. Then, after The Gift came out, that the album that was on, Paul McCartney's office phoned up and said, who took that photograph? So he ended up doing Lindsey Buckingham, and he ended up doing McCartney and Linda.
That's right.
And a series of photographs. And he must have died very soon after that. When people ask me what the highlights of your life, it's not necessarily Live Aid or Band Aid or, you know, the OB Eve and the Queen and stuff. They're all lovely. It's the moments that people don't see. You know, getting your photograph taken by this iconic photographer was wonderful.
Well, have a great show tonight. Look forward to
it. Thank you very much. Yeah. I better get moving because my phone's flashing. That's him saying, hurry up and check. Done the sound check. So it's all right. It's all good.
All right.
Got to get ready.
Well, it was such a thrill for us. We really appreciate it.
No, thanks for doing it, guys.
And we're looking forward to seeing you here in L.A.
Woo! That sounds good.
All right. Take care. Thank you so
much.
All
right, guys. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
See you.
Okay. Do you enjoy our talk with Jim? How did the name Midge come about? We didn't even talk about that. So let's talk about that. How do you become Midge?
It is the reverse. I guess one of the first bands also had a Jim in it. So they started calling him Midge, which is the reverse of Jim, M-I-J, and he just adapted that to Midge. That's my understanding. I would like to confirm that with him. Maybe when we see him at the Zebulon,
okay,
he'll confirm this for us.
There will be an opportunity, maybe. I don't know. We'll jump up on stage and ask him that question. He's playing some intimate venues, and hearing this music is going to be great. It's been great going down this rabbit hole, listening to a lot of his music. And you enjoyed the research part of this project, Holly?
I learned a lot about Midge and the bands in which he's played. But he was so delightful and so humble in a way that's not aw shucks, but he does now seem to recognize the impact that he has had in music. But you can see that he didn't necessarily feel it along the way, and I'm glad he's reaping that now.
I think that happens with age. We start to appreciate things that that we've done. Okay, that wasn't so bad. I should have enjoyed it in the moment. I think a lot of artists and people and regular folk like you and I appreciate things we did back in the day.
Do you think we're going to appreciate the very first podcast we did back in 2018?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, that'll be something. Are we going to appreciate the social media, Holly, that we create here on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
I hope everybody will appreciate the social media right along with us at WDDIM Podcast and on YouTube at What Difference Does It Make Podcast.
All right. You can find our website, WDDIMPodcast.com, which stands for What Difference Does It Make. You can sign up for our newsletter, which we put out every month, a synopsis of everything we did the previous month. It's fun. It's exciting. It should be subscribed to. So do it now. This is your first time listening to us because you love Midge. Well, welcome to it. We put out new episodes every Friday. So please subscribe and give us a review. Let us know what you think.
Thanks to Erica Tucker and to Pantheon Podcasts.
Yes, we are a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast family.
I think we've covered everything. I think it is time to say goodbye.
All right, we've reaped the wild wind. So let's move on. Until next Friday, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.